Welcome, everybody, to the Writers Center. I'm excited to have Jennifer and Cindy here. I've heard a lot about them in the broader North Shore poetry community, and it's great when you get to hear work, especially when it has to do with labor and smashing the patriarchy.
Yeah.
So I'm particularly looking forward to that. Jennifer Martelli is the author of My Tarantella. Most recently, her work has appeared in Tinderbox Poetry, The Bitter Oleander, Sugar House Review, The Baltimore Review, and The Superstition Review. She has been nominated for both the Pushcart and Best of the Net prizes and is the recipient of the Massachusetts Cultural Council grant for poetry. She is a poetry editor for The Mom Egg Review. Jennifer?
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay? I have a pretty loud voice. Thank you so much, Henry and Amanda, for having us up here. I love Gloucester. I've been to readings up here, and it's just it's a great space. I feel like I'm slowly making my way up the North Shore. I grew up in Revere, and I live in Marblehead, and then so I figure, you know, in a few years I'll... Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, there you go.
Connections up there.
I love Maine. So I'm going to read from my new book, My Tarantella, which came out in November from Bordighera Press. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background, you know, the germination of this book. A few years ago, I started writing a couple of poems about Kitty Genovese, who was murdered in New York City in 1964 in Queens. And the story behind that is she was coming home in the middle of the night from work. She was attacked, screamed for help. Nobody helped her. And the story that came down to us is that, you know, 33 people watched this happen, and nobody called the police. So it sort of became, I guess for the time, viral and somewhat fake news because there's a little bit more information about that. So in any event, I started writing some poems about her more. I think I was like, I was really exploring my own Italianness and kind of growing up in the 60s and in Revere in a very Italian-American community. And didn't really think much of it. And I was just writing these poems and collecting my images from that time and my memories and researching her. And then the election in 2016 happened. And that changed the whole narrative of the book. And that's, for me, when the book came together and sort of was about women's voices and trauma and all of that. So some of the poems are going to deal directly with Kitty, some with me, and some with our political landscape. So you'll know what I'm, you know, where I am in history when I'm reading about it. Dear Kitty, I am breaking my own rule talking to the dead for the sake of the living. I want to imply a sense of intimacy between us. I want witnesses and eavesdroppers. I don't believe in consciousness after death. I believe you are gone. But I found a Kodak of me in front of my aluminum Christmas tree, the Advent after you died, my hair short and black like yours in the mugshot, and my cousin in her pink dance skin had your dark bow and arrow eyebrows. The silver was meant to look like a frozen fir tree, the needles iced and shining under the moon. Did the sky above Kew Gardens open like a peacock's tail, all dim oculi, shadow-eyed? Windows are dangerous. We locked everyone, the aunts, my sisters, and all the cousins the night Albert DeSalvo escaped. What is it about us Italians? We fear birds and we fear eyes, but mostly we whisper. Even your killer's son feared the vowel at the end of your name. Your stab wounds were lips. They were eyes, too. Did you know Marianne waited upstairs in your bed? Did you know Sophia held you in the foyer on the slick tiles? Did you know your mother had a stroke after you died? Your story is the bossa nova. It is downtown. Your hair was brown black. Women loved you. It hurts my hoarse throat, my blue heart. You know, it's sad because what we know of Kitty Genovese really is the last half hour of her life, which is a shame because she was an interesting woman for her time. She was a lesbian. She was in a committed relationship. And I often think, had she lived, how she'd be interacting now, you know, in America now, like what her life would be like. The grape arbor in Mr. Angulo's yard was a tangled mess of black vines, the few leaves glowing under moonlight. I've stayed up too late watching scary movies like I did with my mother, eating blue cheese and saltines, my feet tucked under her thighs for warmth on the couch. In the movie tonight, a girl who died a violent death crawls out of an old TV, a vat of oil, a sliver of broken mirror. Her black hair crowns first, then her eyes, and then she looks for you. Mr. Angulo kept big glass jugs of wine so purple it felt like a bruise. His wine hurt deep inside parts of the body, could dye bones, burnt your heart. Sometimes it felt like your lungs deflated, the booze so strong. He had shelves of wine jugs in his cool cellar, rows and rows of glossy black light. All my fears have come to pass. Nothing could ever quell them. So, when I was growing up, my mother cooked the same meals every day of the week. And I had written this poem, you know, Monday we had this, Sunday, you know, and I read it to a friend. And this is the great thing about being in a brutally brilliant and honest poetry community. My friend said, "Who cares what your mother cooked?" It was yeah, but I needed to hear that. I'm like, "You're right. I care, but..." So I changed the poem. So this is what came of that poem. Afterbird 1. In the kitchen with the pink oven, my mother roasted beef each Sunday, and we had a choice of brown gravy or the blood. On the stove with buttons that heated the coils until they glowed like uterine snakes, should simmer brinjal. Meat tied in string. We'd sop bone broth with salad and bread. Sometimes we'd eat on black metal TV trays, all matte painted with fat gold roses. 2. I had a blue plastic kitty bank. She had long black lashes and arched brows, and she was molded sitting on her hind legs with a slit cut in the back of her neck to slip the coins in. I had a doll with hair coiled inside her hollow body. You could pull the hank from her crown. I had a doll with the head of a pure white dog and the body of a woman. No, a girl flat-chested. 3. I had white fringe go-go boots, and I'd dance when my uncle came over. I'd dance to Nancy Sinatra. On the gold fleck linoleum, on the flagstones out front littered with white Andromeda buds, out by the hibachi on the kidney-shaped patio. Paper lanterns and beaked masks hung from the willow tree to the clothesline. 4. I had a grandma who came downstairs for leftovers. Once she talked about how sweet and dense Hanover Street smelled long after they'd cleaned the molasses that flooded the North End in a tide of the cheapest brown sugar. For years in the heat, it smelled of hermits and gingerbread men. 5. Inevitably, it was my mother who rose from the golden flowers painted on the old TV trays, long since rusted in the cellar. She was unhealed even in death, still confused. She came out of the rose's mouth like an afterbirth. That night, the sky was as thin as a giant vat of molasses, so it was easy to come through to split the seams. 6. my mother said, after her own mother died, she saw her rocking in a chair on their front porch. My mother poured herself over me, sweet and sticky, into my mouth, and my eyes were stuck shut by the lashes. I had an image of my mother inside my eyes, an afterbird. 7. We had an electric opener with a magnet to hold the can while it turned against the blade. Saturdays, we ate from a tin. The molasses in the North End that I referenced, it was just the 100-year anniversary of the Great Molasses Flood, which sounds so strange, but I think like something like 11 people were killed in that. More than that, yeah, it was horrible. There was this big, giant vat of molasses in a very unsafe, I mean, I'm talking like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of gallons, and it exploded.
In
the North End. In the North End. Yeah, my grandparents were born there, and people died, yeah. It's horrible.
Animals,
horses, dogs, yeah. Yeah, it was just, and you could smell it. They said for years, like when it rained or got hot, you could still smell that, yeah. Things Kitty Genovese should have. 3 scoop neck Danskins, black, forest green, garnet. Matchbook from the swing rendezvous on McDougal Street. Pearl choker necklace, which rests at the nape of her neck. And a plunging V-back baby blue sateen fitted dress. A horsehair brush and a brown bone comb. Ink sketch of Kitty looking out an apartment window in Kew Gardens. Also by Marianne Zelenko, oil painting of the sketch, cubist, burnt colors. Black flats with jeweled clips, smoky diamond pumps, cigarette pants, tin espresso pot, mascara, a fedora for when she's the man, Piaf, Petula Clark's downtown, and c'est bon sang fait pour ma chère had she lived. Full moon, 5 minutes, window, window. Marianne Zelenko was Kitty's partner. She was an artist. She's still alive. She lives in New Hampshire. And she kind of went into hiding after Kitty's death. There was just no outlet for her, you know, for her grief anywhere. I want to say maybe the past 5 years, she's kind of come out and like made statements about that night. She was upstairs sleeping while it was happening. She had no idea, which is sad. So this next poem, I'm mispronouncing it, I'm sure. It's a Persian form called a ghazal. And the way it works, I guess let's call this an American ghazal. They're in couplets. The poem is in 2-line stanzas. The last word is repeated. So it's not a rhyme, but it's just the word repeated throughout the poem. And then in the very last line of the poem, the author is supposed to state their name. So this is my version of a ghazal. Window. Once, during a long, warm August dusk, I heard a bat outside my bedroom window. I stopped shaking my sheets out, stood by the sheer white curtains covering my window. I decorated my backyard with black and red paper lanterns hanging from the maples. I strung 5 lengths of small white globe lights along my patio below my window. Owl's feathers aren't as heavy as the wings of a bat. Those leathered long finger bones. My black cat stays inside. She watches things fly, watches mammals from her window. My neighbor put a full-length cracked mirror on the sidewalk for trash or for free. I was too ashamed to take it and pick out the glass slivers, so I watched, crouched by my window. When I put my cat down to sleep, she was still as onyx, cold as Pluto's moon, useless as God. All the paper lanterns in my backyard were eaten through masks, eye holes like windows. I have a small china bowl with a tiny brown owl on its lip. The owl looks down into painted blue stars. I keep my name in gold on a chain, cupped safe in that bowl on the sill under my window. So this next poem, again, the false narrative in Kitty's story is that she died alone in the at the bottom of the stairs in the vestibule of her apartment. That isn't true. That was where Winston Mosley found her and attacked her for the second time. Horrible. But what happened was there was a neighbor in the building, a friend, and when she realized something was happening, she rushed down, you know, regardless of, you know, what she was going to find. Her name was Sophia Farrar, and she was the only one who came to her aid, a woman. So this poem, I mean, she's really the heroine, the hero of this story. Men Who Are Afraid of Bats. And it has an epigraph by Sophia Farrar. It kills me when I think about it. The black leather gloves and all cuts all through the gloves on both her hands. D.H. Lawrence described the bats in Pisa, Italy, as serrated wings against the sky, like a glove, a black glove thrown up at the night. He called the flight of bats dark air life looping and confused them for a flight of swallows in the Italian dusk. He feared them, too, those old rags. Sophia yelled to the neighbor, peeking through the slit in his apartment door for a towel. Carl, please, for the blood, the torn open cuts. Kitty was my friend, and I knew she was hurt, Sophia said. That was my reason for flying. She was a little tiny thing. I'm going to come into the modern times, past 2 years now. I discovered about a year or so ago, I'm not really a gardening kind of gal. I don't know a lot. I'm really bad with flowers. But I discovered Queen of Night tulips, which are, they're deep, deep maroon, but they look black. And I'm walking down my street, and my neighbor has all these black tulips growing in her front yard. I was amazed. I'm like, I'd never heard of these things. So there's a bunch of poems that they made their way into the book, too. A god lives in the amygdala. I heard Amy Winehouse today, jacked up fast and techno for my heart. The leaves fell the way Rilke saw them fall, all motioning no, no, no. I heard the brown bats that roost under the bridge over the lead mills, and the cats crying in heat with the wan and want of a baby. I live in a jewel-toned neighborhood. One day, as I stroll past the quietest house, a small forest of Queen of Night tulips blossomed into a whole night sky. Next day, each queen stamen weakened, let loose, and wept. Did you know that nothing outside of our mouths will save us? A god lives in the amygdala, but he is weak too, asleep under the new moon. Did you see an angel's viscera across the sky? Back when I was young and always brokenhearted, I too fell into a fever and drank vodka chilled next to half lemons in the bowl. Discussing elephant puppets the night of the refugee ban. Elephant puppets so big, 10 men can fit under their pipe bodies and manipulate 4 fat limbs and a trunk. Gray veils mimicking a pachydermic funeral, and lapis lazuli eyes big as a bruise on a thigh. We talk about them over an olive sampler at Mia Casa, little bistro tucked into the clapboard block between a bar and a bar, cobblestones, leaded windows, paned. There's that uncanny dip, the sweet valley of something that looks like something else. deep eyes, big as a loaf on the plate, big as a hole in the middle of a nation. This is not my house. We talk about the mammoth elephant puppets, how they seem to dance, but it's men running under the articulated pipes and the sheer veils. And I'm just going to read a couple more. The next poem, I didn't write a single line in this poem. It's a cento or cento. I guess it's a form of a found poem, and the way it works is you take a line from a, you know, a different poem, and you just make a new poem. And obviously, you know, you say, like, I didn't write this poem. This person wrote the poem. So every line in this poem is taken from a poem written by an Italian-American woman writer. Panis, panis, angelicus, acento. The other thing, too, I want to say, I just want to just give you just a little warning. I swear awful, but I try not to in my poems, but there are two swears in here. I don't know why, like, I get, like, oddly prude when I'm writing. In my real life, I'm not, so I didn't write it. Panis, panis, angelicus. I love you because I am Italian and you wear it better. I am afraid I shall not know an American with a familiar kind of face. I'll brew my wine from gold to gray, my nipple like the nib of a pen. Your flesh was unused tissue. They say you lurk here still, perhaps. I got lonely because I was going extinct from giving and giving and giving. There was a smell of woman-made spring here. Narrow windows on a narrow alley. Only the evil eyes of 1,000 buildings that nothing, nothing can shatter. The heat sits on my body with the cumulative weight of dream men. He is creeping prick first into my sleeping bag cunt. We wish to dam this female tide. Something would have to break through with a life of its own. I spent some time in Italy the summer before last. My daughter was over there, so we went there, and it's beautiful. I wish I spoke Italian. Nobody spoke it. They wouldn't speak it around us. So. At the Plaza di Santa Croce, most pigeons' wings shone deep indigo against the basilica's terracotta facade. Before I could enter the cathedral, I had to buy a blue paper shawl to cover my bare shoulders. My left blade with its one ink tattoo of a bass clef, the right, the dark, still face of Kitty Genovese. The lady said to save the shawl for all the churches in Italy. For €1, I was winged, and God wasn't offended. So, and I'm going to end with, this was really the first poem that I wrote that kind of emotionally brought together these two stories for me, Kitty Genovese and the elections. So, Fatal Mouths. The city guys are stringing Christmas lights on the locust trees. The men are lifted in buckets. First, any old witches come down, and then the forgotten paper pumpkins, the bats. The city guys shake loose the dried locust pods, brown and curled. They land on Essex Street like snakes. Finally, the white lights can go up and stay past the new year. If there is a God, his indifference has settled deep within my ribcage country. Last night on television, I saw a woman scrubbed of makeup give a speech. I read about a woman who screamed, but no one came. All over her body, fatal mouths widened with a knife. The city guys string white lights on bare branches and wind them around fat trunks tight, and soon all of Salem will glow. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really wonderful. Cindy Veach is the author of Gloved Against Blood, named a finalist for the 2018 Patterson Poetry Prize. Her poetry has appeared in the Academy of American Poets Poem a Day, Agni, Prairie Schooner, Poet Lore, Michigan Quarterly Review, Salamander, and Elsewhere. I always wonder what that elsewhere means. Love it. She is the co-editor of the Mom Egg Review. Cindy Veach.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. And I have lived all over the North Shore, including Gloucester, Manchester, and now Beverly. So I'm really excited to read here tonight. So I'm going to read from my collection, Gloved Against Blood, and then I'll read a few poems, newer poems from a new manuscript. So the poems in this collection explore inherited or received histories, and it's set against the backdrop of the 19th century patriarchal textile mills of Lowell, Massachusetts, where my great-grandmother worked as a mill girl. And she emigrated from Quebec with her four sisters and, worked there for a few years and then ended up getting married and having 13 children. So I never knew her. My mother, now in retrospect, it was the beginning of her memory issues, started to talk obsessively about her childhood and her girlhood and telling stories that I'd never heard before. She was an only child, and her mother was a single mother. Her husband had abandoned them when my mother was two. So she spent a lot of time with this grandmother, my great-grandmother. And what I, in writing this book, I wanted to sort of connect with her through the mills, which was a part of her life that even my mother didn't know anything about. So I wanted to explore the narratives, not just of her and the women in my family, but also the mill girls. And in sort of doing that research and getting to know these narratives, one of the things that I discovered was sort of the idea of things unraveling. So that was marriages, faith, memory, the mills themselves. Great Red Wall. This is the Merrimack, the Charles, the Concord, and this, the red brick of mills, the home of warp and weft that lured them from their failing farms to toil cotton into cloth 13 hours a day. And this red brick on brick on brick is all that's left of sweat and linty lungs. Can you see them years later? In these offices, these cubicles, these cute boutiques with clothes made in Bangladesh, or sitting in the hip cafes that sell espresso 15 ways. Here is where they spent their days, where factory bells rang come and done. One of the books that I used for research is called The Lowell Offering, and it's a collection. It was a literary journal for the mill girls, so they could publish their stories, which they say are not true, that they're fiction, but they were based heavily on their experiences. So there are a few poems in the book that are persona poems, so they're written in the voice of Mill Girl. How it resists. And sometimes it's too much, these aisles of crowded looms, their stanchions of white thread spooling like udders, my needy shuttles of flowering dogwood, for its hardness, for how it resists splintering, for the way it loves to be polished smooth. Some days the floor slants, the room seems cockeyed, light muddles, too slim for eyes to see the eye, and the whole mill howls as if cotton were milk, the way two mirrors held just right create an infinity of eye. This next poem, it is a persona poem. It's speaking in the voice of my great-grandmother, but it's really informed by a story in the Lowell Offering, which is called A Weaver's Reverie, and there are some lines in it from that story. Theft. How I came down from Quebec to work in the mills. How I never imagined it would be such hell. How industry, how factory bell. How many miles of cloth I conjured from the bloody cotton. How my eyes couldn't get enough of the one window, the great out there. How I lied about a cloudless sky. There was one solitary cloud far up in the cerulean vault. How I schemed to leave, steal my wages instead of sending them back home to make a gentleman of my brother. My heart fluttered like a prisoned bird with painful longings for an unchecked flight. How your grandmother, mother, you, how your daughter, because I came here, because I did not flee. So the livelihood of the mills depended not just on the mill girls, but it also depended on the labor of enslaved African Americans in the South. And many of the mill girls were abolitionists, including the poet Lucy Larcom, who was from Beverly. You may have heard of her. So this next poem is a guzzle, as I have my own guzzle here. And it addresses Francis Cabot Lowell. He was the founder of the first textile mill that was able to take raw cotton and turn it to cloth under one roof. And because of that, increased the demand for cotton because it increased productivity. There are a few lines from one of Lucy Larcom's poems in here. You might be able to hear it. It's in italics if you see the print. So as Jen said, in a guzzle, there's it's couplets, and there's one word at the end. In this case, it's the word row that always will appear at the end of each couplet. Dear Francis Cabot Lowell, how is it you don't see all down the row? Blood bobbins, all down the row. I've heard fields of white bowls, each puff turned up to the sun, are beautiful by the row. But at what price this accursed fiber that threads your looms all in a row? Every day I feel that I'm sinning against the light to stay still in a row. Turn those fields 10,000 times, the blood of souls in bondage will thicken by the row. Francis, you are the sin, not these cloven white perennials planted in a row. They bleed, I weave, they bleed. Why can't you see blood threads your looms all down the row? So the next few poems I'll read are all sort of themed around the theme of unraveling. So the idea of needlework being so precise and yet ultimately unraveling. And the women in my family did a lot of needlework, as did the mill girls. At the end of their shifts, they'd gather in the common room and they'd work on, you know, knitting, crocheting, mending, whatever it was. You know, I have some of my grandmother's needlework, and it is, even though it's been cared for, it's falling apart. It's not going to last. So that kind of created a lens for me to talk about things unraveling. So some of these have to do with sewing and others don't. Notions. Mother of pearl and bone buttons, Coates and Clark thread. I'd sort and touch every notion in her basket with its silk loops for thimbles and pine posts for bobbins. First day of school outfits, hems, elbow, and knee patches she conjured from that basket. I need some notions meant a trip to Woolworth's, ice cream at the soda fountain for me, every flavor of rickrack, bias tape, grow grain for her. How she could darn socks by the hour, create buttonholes by hand, always kept her notions organized and neat so she could find what she needed, a rhinestone button, safety pins, scarlet embroidery floss to stitch I love you. She said a woman could never have enough. Fabric could unravel, split, fray, but a woman with notions could mend what was torn, make it like new, button up against his absence. Absent. He left, not as leaves leave, anticipated, lauded, each scarlet, boutonniered usher cartwheeling, top spinning, down into bright spoils heaped at our feet. not as something erased, where then the branches emptied brim over it with blue, but as a tree splits, cleaved to the quick, roots uprooted, ants, aphids, nematodes disowned in the dark, in the eye of it. This next poem has an epigraph, and it's from, the source is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the 12th Annual Report of the Bureau of Statistics of Labor, 1881. And it reads, with some exceptions, the Canadian French are the Chinese of the Eastern States. Accent. It's true my people were scabs who crossed picket lines in the dark, weren't afraid to turn fingers into bone or ruin their hearing from the din of screeching looms. French filled the home where my grandmother was born and raised, white clapboard with a glassed-in porch on a curving street. She drove me past when she still drove. Rough times in Lowell after the mills shut down. I made fun of her Yankee accent, ka and yad. She worked hard to talk like that. My father's name is Carson, and she would always call him Carson. And there's some French in this poem, and I apologize in advance. Ordinary art. Once you spoke French, you say, and sometimes there was bread, du pain, with milk and sugar before bed. Once there was cream tuna on toast with green peas, ribbon candy that cut your tongue, and later cigarettes instead of lollipops or bubblegum. Once you believed in God, you say, then he, votre père, walked out, and your mother made an ulcer. After that, it was white bread, boiled dinners, whatever it took to coat her pain. What happens now as you disappear, as she did, brain cell by brain cell? Is that our story? So I'll read one more from the book. This one has an epigraph from Alice Moore Dunbar Nelson. The little useless seam, the idle patch, this pretty futile seam. French seams. From Nanny Parkereau, I learned to sew French seams. Seams that hide raw edges within the seam itself. Seams that won't unravel, that are neat, even on the wrong side. Finished, she'd say. Seams that take planning, accurate estimating, extra fabric. Each one folded over twice. Making allowances, she called it. Hers were meticulous, unrivaled. They could be counted on to hold. They never ripped or frayed. Still, the marriage unraveled early. She had to stitch shoes at McElwain's in Nashua and raise a latchkey kid. When Social Security could not sustain her, she came to live with us, garter-stitched dish rags, all she could manage when senility set in. From Nanny Parkereau, I learned to hide raw edges within the seam itself, each one folded over twice, making allowances, she called it. Even on the wrong side, I would not rip or fray. I would be counted on to hold. I would be neat, meticulous, unrivaled. It would take planning, accurate estimating, extra fabric. Still, the marriage raveled. I had to stitch and stitch, fold and fold and fold, all that extra yardage. I could not salvage us. Finished, she'd say. Okay, so change of scene here. I have a new manuscript that is themed around the Salem witch trials, and also the witch kitsch culture of Salem, Massachusetts. So I don't know if when I spend time in Salem, and I spend a fair amount of time there, I feel cognitive dissonance between the culture there, current culture, which really is the witch kitsch and Halloween, and then what happened there in 1692, and 20 innocent people were murdered. So this manuscript explores that sort of cognitive dissonance. So I'm going to read probably three or four poems from that. Spectral evidence. because she said she saw, and therefore, these pinholes in her skin, on one arm to be exact, look how they crisscross, make a doily of the flesh. And because she said she saw you, not you, take a small pin from your pocket, a straight pin with a flat head. And because she said it was, therefore you, therefore not a dream, puncturing each pore, you in the flesh, not flesh, with a common pin. So spectral evidence was accepted testimony back in the day, and then you could be murdered for someone's just saying, hey, your apparition did this to me. Rebecca Nurse, hanged July 19, 1692. At first, the jury returned not guilty, to which the judge said, retire and reconsider the not. After all, she had not answered the question she had not heard. Guilty of being hard of hearing, maybe mouthing what? Guilty of having a temper, arguing with neighbors. Guilty, too, of piety, 39 attesting to her deep devotion. Still the afflicted swore it was her apparition that did the pinchings and prickings of their flesh. And in court, when she raised her arms, the afflicted raised their arms. And when she inclined her head, the afflicted inclined their heads. So the University of Virginia did a project where they transcribed and digitized all of the trial testimony, all of the depositions and all of the testimony in court, and it's all available to the public. So I've spent a lot of time on that site, and the poems actually incorporate some of that testimony. So they're actual words. It's very chilling to read it, and sort of some of that's embedded in the poems. I'm just going to read two more poems. Elizabeth Howe, hanged July 19, 1692. I had to be my husband's eyes, the light that could not reach them, leading him about by the hand, tilling the land my father gave me, running the household, and for this they would not let me come into the church of Ipswich. And for this they said I bewitched horses, cows, sows, and was the cause of sorrows that killed the Pearlie's little Hannah. No, never in all my life. I saw I had to be the husband, eyes, mouth, muscle, and took the lead and hanged for it. And then the last one I'll read. Eye witch. So what if I woke up changed? It's not like I'm a wild hog or some evil thing, not a real hog that follows you home, jumps into the window, a monkey with cock's feet with claws. Don't believe what my accuser says, or believe it. The fact is, my divorce attorney's building sits on the site of the prison where they kept the accused in chains in 1692. I came there with a silk scarf worn loosely at the neck, borders looped with colored thread. He came with daisies, dark chocolate, and proclaimed, my wife came towards me and found fault with me. Downstairs in the dungeon, they chained us to the walls to keep our spirits from escaping in the likeness of a bird. Thank you. Thanks.